Hello and welcome to your Community Radio News Desk. I'm Adrienne Murphy. And coming up on today's programme, Ciarán Murray chats with Áine Ní Laffan from Limerick and Imrani Verca from Monaghan about bringing their children up in the Irish language. Sally Galliana talks to Gábor Getzi, who collaborates with the Community Radio Civil Radio in Budapest to discuss the current situation in Hungary. But first, author Sarah Webb joined Patrick Donoghue on Beyond the Back Page in Near FM to talk about some incredible sportswomen included in her new book, Blazing a Trail. Patrick began by asking her what inspired her to write this book.
Well, I would be a big reader myself, and I have a daughter and two sons, so I share books with them all the time. And I often realise with the general kind of history sports books that there were very few women in the pages. So if I was reading history of sport in Ireland, there might be one or two women, but very few. If I was reading about science, very few. So I thought, well, you know, I'd like to do something about that. So I started doing a little digging, and I realized that there were lots and lots of women doing remarkable things in the past. It's just that they haven't always been documented in books. So that was kind of what started me off.
Looking at the sports people featured, the first name that cropped up and when I was looking at, and I must confess I never heard of her, Anne O'Brien. She was the footballer. Can you tell us a bit about her? Or she was an incredible woman.
Yeah, she was amazing. Now, what I did is there's a couple of areas where I wouldn't be as strong in, and I have to admit, Patrick, sport would be one of them. Although I'm a keen watcher of sport, I wouldn't be an expert. So what I did is I reached out to Mary Hannigan in the Irish Times and also the lad in News Talk on Off the Ball. And I asked a few sports people, well, who were your incredible Irish sports people? And Mary said Anne O'Brien, and I'd never heard of her. So she sent me some links to articles because there's no books about Anne. So Anne was a professional international footballer for 18 years. In Italy and in France. She played for Stade de Reims, and she played for Lazio and all kinds of amazing, amazing teams. And when I talk to the girls and boys in schools about this book, the lads always go, oh, Lazio. No, I must admit, I'm not sure who they are, but apparently they're an incredible team in Italy. And so they were always very impressed by that. But she basically was spotted by the French coach who asked her to join his team. And then she was headhunted by the Italians to play in the Italian Series A. And she won loads of cups and awards, leagues and cups during her time. And then she became a football coach. You know, she was related as well to Johnny Giles and Jimmy Conway. So there was football in her blood. She was from Inchicore.
Yeah, it was incredible. And reading your piece about her, like, even like I've heard people, sports people talking, and to talk about being homesick, and like when she moved over, she was only 17, and she mastered the French language so quickly. So it was just such a great achievement what she did.
And then not only did she master French, then she mastered Italian. And then she lived the rest of her life in Italian. And she has a son who unfortunately she passed away in 2016. But I was very privileged to meet her family, the O'Brien family, who I think she had lots of brothers and sisters. And I met some of them at the book launch, including Tony. And they were very helpful just with some of the facts for the piece, because obviously there's not that much written about her.
No, it's incredible. And I think that's the great thing about the book. I've been reading it over the last few days. Like, it gives you a sense that you can read more about these people. Like that, I thought that was a brilliant thing about it.
Yeah, well, what I was trying to do is capture the spirit of each of the women. Like, Anne was just a very strong, committed, fun, loving woman. And so each, like Sonia Sullivan, very driven, very ambitious, you know, to capture each of the women's kind of spirit. And as well as obviously all their achievements and facts, which are interesting. But I think a list of facts wouldn't be interesting to anyone. What you're trying to do is make them kind of come alive on the page, you know.
On them coming alive, I must say, the illustrations are really
fantastic.
Great.
So those were by Lauren O'Neill, who is a young Irish illustrator. And again, she was just trying to capture the women's kind of spirit on the page. And I think she did a brilliant job. Some of them are hilarious.
Yeah.
I love her Mary Robinson. It's particularly funny.
Yeah.
And it's great.
And another incredible woman, a real trailblazer, I want to ask you about, Maeve Kyle. Could you tell us maybe a bit about her?
So Maeve Kyle was another woman that I hadn't heard of. And she was the first woman to represent us in the Olympics. So she was born in 1928. And she's originally from Kilkenny.
Yeah.
She played hockey as a young woman. She played for Ireland 58 times.
Yeah.
And then she met Sean Kyle, who became her husband and her running coach. And she became one of the star athletes in Ballymena and Antrim Athletics Club. So in 1956, Maeve was chosen to compete for Ireland in the Olympics. And she got a terrible time. People called her unladylike.
Yeah.
She was denounced from the pulpit by the priest. And there were letters in the paper saying that she was a disgrace. People threw things at her when she was out training. They threw boots and bottles and things at her. Because they just didn't believe a woman should be running around in shorts and leaving her children behind, even though it was actually her husband who was training her, and he was very happy for her to go and represent her country. So she went on to represent Ireland then in 1960 in the Olympics and in 1964 in Tokyo. And she really came into her own as a in the Masters and won 30 medals in international championships during her career. But she was amazing. So she paved the way for people like Sonia Sullivan and Catherine McKiernan and all the people who have come after her. She was incredible. But I love her tenacity, you know, and I love the fact that she was getting a lot of flack, but she just kept going.
Yeah.
It was brilliant.
And you mentioned in one of the bit, even getting to Australia in her first Olympics, she had to fund herself to go over.
Yes, she did. She had to raise £200, which was a huge amount at the time. Yeah. And she didn't have the backup that, you know, that the sports people would have today, although I know they're largely not that well funded now either.
Yeah.
But she really had to deal with her own kit. She ended up washing a lot of boys and ironing a lot of the boys' kit. She took on a kind of mammy role, I think, over there. But she was an amazing woman.
No, and a common theme in your book, the likes of Maeve Kyle, they, like, nowadays it's easier. I know there's a lot of barriers, but they kind of, as you said, they did pave the way for other people. The athletes now don't have them barriers. So they were real, real trailblazers, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely they were. I mean, if you think it was only, there's another woman in the book called Lady Heath, and it was due to her hard work that she fought and fought and fought for women to be allowed to compete in athletics in the Olympics, because before that they were only doing things like, you know, archery and painting.
Yeah.
Did you know there was painting in the Olympics in years past, which I thought was hilarious?
Yeah.
But she campaigned for women to compete in athletics. And it was only in 1928 that women were allowed to compete in athletics and gymnastics, which gymnastics, as we now know, is huge, women's gymnastics. But and she was another woman. She was called Sophie Mary Pierce Evans. She was from Limerick. She married James Heath, who was an English politician, and became Lady Heath.
Yeah.
And she was an aviator, so a sportswoman in her own right. And she actually took part in, she set world records herself for high jump and the javelin. She was over 6 foot tall. So she was another sportswoman from our past.
And that was Sarah Webb talking to Patrick Donoghue on Near FM's Beyond the Back Page. Now, many of us think that Irish is only spoken as a first language in homes in the Gaeltacht areas. But this isn't necessarily the case. All over the country, people choose to speak Irish at home as their first language. To learn more about this, Ciarán Murray spoke to Áine Ní Laffan from Limerick and Imrí Verca from Monaghan, and he started by asking them why they chose to bring up their children in the Irish language.
Well, I had Irish at home, not 100% of the time, but a good amount of the time at home in Monaghan. But when I had my own children, I decided that I just wanted them to have what I had, because I'd had a good experience with it. And on top of that, I wanted them to understand their own language, their own culture, and be comfortable with it. And I felt like I always had something extra that some other people didn't have. And I feel like my kids have that too.
And Anya, what about you?
So for us, I suppose myself and my husband were always interested in Irish. We didn't speak Irish at home, either of us, growing up, but we spoke to each other a bit, you know, at home. But then what happened actually was my brother married a girl from America who was very interested in culture and heritage. And it was actually her that suggested to my brother, you know, would he consider bringing their children up through Irish. So they were living in the States at the time. And when they used to come back to Ireland for a few months every year, and we would speak Irish to them. So we had an opportunity to see firsthand just how well it worked. And, you know, it really amazed us to see how effortlessly my niece, you know, she was maybe 3 at the time, and how effortlessly she could switch from Irish to English, depending on who she was speaking with. That exposure, I suppose, it was the main reason, the main influence for us deciding to rear our children through Irish.
Is it difficult if it's not your first language, if you were brought up either entirely or mostly through English? Is it difficult then for you to use Irish as a first language?
I wouldn't. It's not that it's difficult, but, you know, it definitely does challenge us at times. I mean, both myself and my husband had a good level of Irish, you know, growing up. Our eldest boy is now 4.5, so we have been improving our Irish gradually over the years with him, you know, through things like reading books to him in Irish. We've got plenty of CDs that have songs and nursery rhymes in Irish. But, you know, I will admit, you know, as he gets older, it is becoming more challenged to keep up with his language needs. Having said that, you know, we're not alone in teaching him Irish because he attends a local Niemer. We go on our holidays to the Gaeltacht. So, and we also have a good network of Irish enthusiasts here in Limerick. So, you know, that's a huge support.
What do people think of this generally when you're in the supermarket or on the bus or something? What's the reaction you get?
I'd say a very positive reaction. Most people think, like, you know, we're some kind of a wonder, but always very positive smiles. A lot of people trying to use their own little wee bit of Gaelic that they have, like Díogaitch or Gura Mahagot, and a huge proportion of people saying, oh, I wish we could speak Irish, I wish, and it's such a shame that we can't. And my answer to that always is, it's never too late.
And Anya, what's it like in Limerick when people hear you speaking Irish in the street to the children?
Yeah, similar to what Emer mentioned, I mean, people are, on the whole, they're extremely positive, and they'll, you know, people will often stop us and say, oh, you know, they'll comment on how lovely it is to hear the Irish being spoken. And also, if they have any Irish themselves, they'll often start to use the cúpla focal with the children, you know. So very, very positive.
What about things like radio and television and the internet? Is that good? Is there lots of Irish there, or how does that work?
I think most of the stuff on the internet or TV that my kids are exposed to is mostly through English, and that's a bit of a battle. The stuff that they're interested in is the stuff that all their peers are interested in. They want to chat about them, whatever. There's stuff on TG Cahir, which is very good. It's probably geared towards younger kids. But yeah, my kids are at the point where they're definitely want to watch what their peers are watching, and that's mostly English stuff. But yeah, there is stuff out there, and definitely could be more.
Anya, your children are a bit younger. You were saying, what's TG Cahir like for them?
Yeah, so it's fantastic for them, as in we've plenty of, there's lots of programmes on that they are still interested in. I mean, my youngest, he's only 2, so he goes around the house saying, Cúla Cahir, Cúla Cahir, and he's very happy to watch it. My four-year-old, he's happy to watch it, but already I can see the influence from, you know, his peers. You know, he'll ask for RT Junior, but in saying that, he's still, as Emer mentioned, you know, I think a lot of the programmes would be geared more for the younger children on TG Cahir, you know.
Do you have Radio na Gaeltacht talked on all the time at home?
I would have it on sometimes, but like I suppose it's above their heads for my kids anyway, and I'm sure yours as well, Anya. But I would have CDs. I'd get, say, some of the CDs that Seachtain na Gaeilge would put out, or anything, even the Irish songs we learned at school, little rhymes and songs that for young kids, we'd play them in the car mainly. But the kids really love them, and often because they're learning them at school, then they feel like, you know, oh great, you know, you've got something that we've got at school. So they're more enthusiastic when they've had more exposure. It's not just mummy pushing it on them.
And Anya?
Yeah, I wouldn't admit now. I'm not. Wouldn't be great for listening to Radio Na Gaeltachta myself.
Yeah.
And similarly to Emer, we'd have a lot of CDs, both you know stories and songs and rhymes that we'd have on in the house and in the car, and the kids love those. And actually, there's even now great apps on the phone, you know, for telling stories on Goom. They have you know plenty of stories available. So our 4.5-year-old absolutely loves those.
That's interesting. Irish has moved with technology as well, and you can't get an app.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, so do you think then, out in the wilder world, is there support from Glór na Gael, or do you want to tell us how that kind of works for you or doesn't work for you?
Well, yeah, so I've been in contact with Glór na Gael, say, through the going to the Gaeltacht every summer. We've only started last summer, but our intention is to be there again this summer. Going to the Gaeltacht with the kids, the whole family, and meeting up with other families for a week and doing loads of activities all through Irish. Everything's fun. There's pretty much no downtime, but great fun. And the kids, when we went last year, absolutely loved it and met other pals, you know, who were loving it as well. Then as well as that, we're going now, not this weekend, the following weekend, we're heading off to An Ryan in Waterford for a weekend in the Gaeltacht with Glór na Gael. Again, meeting up with other families who are rearing their kids through Irish. So, and we're also taking part in project through the schools. So through Gaelscoileanna, where families who are rearing their kids through Irish get some funding from Glór na Gael and from the school to put on some activities for the kids. So we're going bowling this Saturday, and we have the intention of having a few, I think about three more activities before the end of the school year. So it's trying to give them the exposure time to have fun through Irish. But yeah, it's great. The support is great. Like, because you'd be, you know, it's encouragement, and you might be as inclined to organise a particular.
You can feel very lonely or isolated if you don't.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there a network in Limerick?
There is a network in Limerick. Actually, we have we've set up a group called Co-Luder Limney. As part of that group, we would organise various family friendly activities, you know, during the year. So that has been absolutely like hugely beneficial for us, just in terms of networking with other families that are bringing their kids up through Irish. I mean, you know, when we moved back here initially, we kind of thought, oh, we're the only ones doing this, but there's at least 10 families that we now know of, and I'm sure there's more out there, as in the thing is trying to get, you know, to get the word out there. But yeah, so we're very lucky to have Co-Luder Limley. But just I'd like to just say something just about Glór na Gael, just to say like what a fantastic organisation it is, and they're very practical on both a national and local level. So nationally, it is fantastic to have such an organisation like that brings together families that are rearing their children through Irish outside the Gaeltacht. You know, they have a monthly newsletter, WhatsApp groups that give you information about holidays and various weekends that are on during the year. And then just on a local level, Glór na Gael supports us both financially, but more importantly, with feet on the ground. So in Limerick, we're very, very lucky to have Cabrini de Barra working for this area. So she's been helping us to grow Co-Luder Limney and just helping to bring the families together that are rearing their children to Irish. So that's been an absolutely fantastic support, you know.
That was Áine Ní Laffan from Limerick and Emer Ní Mhearcha from Monaghan. And to learn more about raising children through Irish, visit Glór na Gael on their website or on their Facebook page. Or you can contact them through Twitter at GLORNANGAEL. And finally, thousands of Hungarians have protested in Budapest and other cities in Hungary against their government's introduction of a slave law that nearly doubles how much overtime employees should work. The demonstrations began last December when the government passed this law, which protesters allege is an attack on democracy. This slave law allows Hungarian firms to demand 400 hours of annual overtime from workers and gives them 3 years to make payment for it. This prompted union leaders to join forces with politicians and activists who want Prime Minister Viktor Orbán to guarantee the independence of Hungary's beleaguered law courts and public media. These complaints chime with international criticism of Hungary's government, which has been sued by the European Union for its hardline policies on immigration, non-government organisations and education reform that has forced the liberal Central European University to move most of its courses from Budapest in Hungary to Vienna in Austria. Sally Galliana spoke with Gábor Getzi, who collaborates with Civil Radio in Budapest, to discuss the current situation in Hungary.
They were about the nullification of the so-called slave law, which is basically the overtime law, actually a modification of the labor law, because the government, or actually the parliament, adopted this modification in December, in mid-December, and it's valid from the 1st of January, and which means that the modification raised the hours of overtime to be requested from 250 to 400 in 1 year. And it also elevates the maximum period of settling overtime payment from 12 to 36 months, 3 years. So that was the main cause of these demonstrations. But they also went further because the trade unions were together with them, and they also look for higher wages and also look for some modifications or changes in the strike law and more flexible retirement. But they went even further than that, because they were talking about the removal of the present political system and the restoration of democracy and putting back the republic, let alone the freedom of press.
Who is actually in government in Hungary?
Well, all right. It's a coalition of the Fidesz and the KNDP. KNDP is the Christian Democratic Party, and they came into power in 2010 and immediately changed the media law, among others. The problem is that they are not ready to conduct genuine dialogue between professional societies, civil societies, before making any laws or any modifications in laws. And probably that's what those people think who are demonstrating.
Yeah, this Fidesz party, how can we define it? Are there extreme right-wing, nationalist right-wing?
I would say it's a conservative, a little bit right-wing. They started out as liberal after 89, you know, but then Mr. Orban changed the whole course. So now they are towards the conservative right-wing. Not extreme, but somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, actually, as we are speaking on Wednesday, was the 30th of January, the European Parliament started debating the current democratic situation in Hungary. I think there are a bit concerns about how the Orbán government is actually impacting in some of the basic democratic rights. You mentioned earlier on how in 2010, when Orban took power, the first thing that they did was to change the media law. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
The problem is that the whole public service mediums are close to the government, I would say the servants of the government, and most of the rural newspapers and television channels were bought up also by the government. And there are still commercial sector, there are still mediums, radios, televisions, and some newspapers, and there are a few community stations, radio stations mostly, and there are quite a lot internet sites which can make an alternative to the government bullhorn of news. So there will be two elections in Hungary. One is the EP elections, and the second one in October sometime, the local elections in Hungary. And the EP elections, well, the problem is that the average Hungarian is mostly interested in keeping their jobs and having regular income, and almost half of the Hungarian population voted for Fidesz because of that. And probably, that's my opinion, they are less care about an independent jurisdiction or an independent lawmaking or a genuine dialogue between professional and civil societies. So that's the problem that the EP sees very well when they are doing these condemnations, you know. And the reason the government says why they didn't, the prime minister didn't go there this time, because they think that it's part of the campaign of the European countries for the EP elections, and that is why they didn't go there. But their representatives were there. Now Hungary has 21 representatives there, and now I think 12 is from Fidesz, and they want to change it. I mean, the opposition and they try to do a common list, but it's not easy because at least one or two parties always stand out, like LMP, which is the Green Party in Hungary, and the Humor Party, which is called Two-Tailed Dog Party. And if they stay out, you know, it can be very harmful. So if they really want the majority of EP members from Hungary to be majority, then they have to stick together and try to do a common party list.
One of the main focus on Hungary probably started in 2016, with what it was called the refugee crisis, and the decision then of the Hungarian government basically of close the borders, and then it follow up with some decisions in relation to the not respect the quota system that was proposed by the European Union in relation to setting a number, a specific number of percentage of refugees. I think that apart from that, there have been a very big campaign also in some way related to this, that is particularly against an individual called George Soros. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Who is Soros, for a start? Because he's Hungarian, isn't he?
Yes, he's Hungarian. He actually fled from Hungary around, I think, 1944, because the Jews were expelled and there were laws against the Jews. So he went abroad, stayed in the United States, and he became an economist, and he got rich probably from, you know, in the money market. And he could also, he first went to London, and I think he went to school somewhere in Oxford, and that's where he learned about the Open Society, which is a very sympathetic idea, and he is fighting for this idea even today. And that's why he helped a lot of non-profit institutions, not only in the United States, I would say almost all of the world, but mostly in Eastern Europe. And after 89, he helped a lot of public servants and a lot of small entrepreneurs to go to study trips to the United States, also helped the elections with equipment, et cetera, et cetera. And the government accuses constantly him of financing the migrants to come to Europe, to come to Hungary, and also they accuse him of influencing the European Union, which to my mind is not true. Or I don't have enough information, but looking at what good he has done already worldwide, I think it's at least dubious.
I suppose that the main question here is, you said there are European and local elections now in this year in Hungary. Do you think there will be any change in the political landscape in these elections?
I do hope that there would be some changes, all the more since it is announced already that on the 14th of March this year, there is going to be a nationwide strike in Hungary. And a lot of public servant trade unions joined to this initiative, and also the police trade union, because they are civil servants too, and they have a lot of overtime working, and their payment is always late. So there is some hope, and I think I would tell you that I share the opinion of a Hungarian writer who says that Hungarians are like gunpowder. They just burn and puff in the open air, but if they press a stone on them too long time, they burst out and explode. So that's what happened in 1848, and that's what happened after the First World War, and that's what happened in 1956. And I think, this is my opinion, this will happen again, but we don't know when. Maybe the first changes will be in October during the local elections, but just a question of time. That's what I think.
And our thanks to Gábor Getzsi from Civil Radio in Budapest for that interview.